Hey folks, today's episode of the podcast is brought to you by Valvoline, the original motor oil. That's right, Valvoline is America's very first motor oil brand. For 150 years, they've been innovating, creating, and reinventing motor oil. From the first high mileage to the first synthetic blend to the first racing oil, they've never stopped pursuing innovation to maximize engine life. Their latest innovation, extended protection full synthetic motor oil, provides 50% better wear protection than industry standards and is 10 times stronger against oil breakdown. Valvoline Extended Protection is specifically formulated with dual defense additive technology, which combines an innovative additive boosted with a fortified detergent system. You may not think that you're a severe driver, but short trips, towing, extreme temperatures, turbocharged engines, heavy loads, and spirited drives will all put extra pressure on your engine. Just listen to people like Chris Forsberg, Rob Dom, Freddie Tavares Hernandez, Speed Academy, Gears and Gasoline, Dustin Williams, and TJ Hunt, all trusting Valvoline in their cars. Valvoline is the only motor oil that has a dedicated engine lab where they can run specialized engine tests and standardized engine tests right in their own facility. They're also the number one supplier of EV battery fluids globally, offering tailored products to help extend vehicle range and efficiency. Find Valvoline now at your local auto parts store. Ask for extended protection full synthetic by name. We're also brought to you today by Talkspace. Listen, we talked about it on one of the shows this week about mental health and what keeps people from seeking it out. There could be peer pressure. It could be the fear of talking to a stranger. It could be the thought of family or friends judging you. And it might be just not knowing where to go or where to start. And meeting a therapist to work on your mental health is just as helpful as hiring a personal trainer to work on your physical health. And the positive impact can be just as life-changing. I should know. I have been seeing a therapist both in person and virtually for about 20 years. Talkspace makes it possible to speak with a licensed therapist right from your phone, tablet, or computer. And unlike traditional therapy, you can message your therapist anytime via text, video, or voice. It is 100% secure, stigma-free, the way that therapy should be. I think therapy is really important because it allows me to put my thoughts and experiences into context with an expert who will not judge me, who doesn't bring their own opinions to the table. They don't also speak to the people that I'm talking about. And it's not like talking to a stranger. It's like talking to an educated person who can give you the whys and lead you the right way to figuring out your own issues. It's great. And at Talkspace, your privacy and security are their number one priority. You can send messages 24/7 and get replies throughout the day. And their encryption and added security features keep your conversation fully protected. Whether you struggle with anxiety, depression, self-doubt, or anything else, Talkspace gives you access to the help you need to move forward. Getting professional help isn't weird. It isn't weak. It's smart. Because your friend or your family, they might know a thing or two about electricity, but would you let them rewire your house? No, you leave it to the professionals. So join Talkspace today and start moving forward with a single message. Just go to Talkspace.com. That's just like it sounds, Talkspace.com, and get $100 off your first month when you use promo code TIRE at sign up. $100 off your first month with promo code TIRE at sign up. That's $100 off at Talkspace.com with promo code TIRE. This Christmas season, holiday season, whether it's Hanukkah, Christmas, Festivus, whatever you might celebrate, think about Stance. Why? Because it's like a meme at this point, giving someone socks and underwear. It's the kind of thing they're like, it's so corny that it's a joke, but Stance brings that joke back around to being an awesome gift, right? Like when people were talking about giving socks, I was like, okay, well, yes, we'll do an ad for socks. Fine. I didn't think it could be that big of a deal. But then they sent me three pairs of socks and I was shocked. I'm actually wearing the Stance socks right now. And it's not because I'm being paid to. I put the socks into my sock drawer in heavy rotation. I really like the gray and whites they got. I really like the Star Wars ones they sent me. I've even rocked the Bob Marley socks. They're soft. They're durable. I've washed them like three or four times already, and they haven't lost their stretchiness. They haven't gotten too tight or too loose. I am a believer. Stance Apparel represents a radical reinvention of socks, underwear, and active apparel with a sharp focus on comfort, quality, and creativity. Stance brings an atypical aesthetic alongside some of pop culture's hottest collaborators for the ultimate in style and self-expression. Because everything you wear should be a direct extension of who you are and how you feel. Fun socks are cool. Everyone who's cool wears really fun socks. You look at celebrities, they wear like a tuxedo with like fun, crazy socks. That's a style thing now. So I really am into the Stance socks they sent me. They're very soft. They're very comfortable. They have good padding. The quality is extremely premium. And Stance believes that the perfect fit matters more than fitting in. And those who feel good do good. So go see for yourself. Register for an account at Stance and get 15% off your first purchase. Use promo code TIRE at checkout to apply. Enjoy the color and comfort of a life less ordinary with Stance. Go to stance.com and use code TIRE at checkout for 15% off. Lastly, of course, it's HelloFresh. I love HelloFresh because you get free pre-portioned ingredients and seasonal recipes delivered right to your door. Skip trips to the grocery store and count on HelloFresh to make home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. Like, for instance, tonight, I would like to make dinner. I don't want to order dinner. I don't want to go to a restaurant. I want to cook dinner. But I don't want to stop at the grocery store on the way home. I don't want to think about what I have to make now. I don't want to like spend the time finding a new recipe, trying something brand new right now at the end of a long work day. The holidays are hectic. Work is hectic. But HelloFresh can keep things simple with recipes that cut back on meal prep, cut back on cleanup, so you can spend less time in the kitchen and more time with your friends and family. They've got 50 menu and market items to choose from every week, ingredients from the farm to your door within a week, so you get the convenience without skimping on the quality. Plus, you skip trips to the grocery store, avoid the long holiday lines. A HelloFresh meal takes around 30 minutes to make, start to finish. They've even got quick and easy meals with 20-minute recipes, low prep, easy cleanup options. Get the food on the table so you can get on with your life. They've got the seasons entertaining covered with options like their holiday cheese and charcuterie board and skinny dip dark chocolate peppermint almonds. They've even got desserts like ginger spice cake truffles and cherry cheesecake swirl bars. You can save $65 a month over the grocery store when you order HelloFresh now. More money to spend on gifts and activities. And I, as a home cook, really like HelloFresh because it makes my mind work on new recipes. I don't have to rely on the same five or six things that I make over and over that I default on because my brain gets lazy because I'm thinking about work. So there's stuff like balsamic and fig beef tenderloin, pecan crusted salmon, chicken sausage and sweet potato soup, things I wouldn't necessarily think of making on my own, but they give me the recipe, they give me the ingredients, and I am good to go. So go to HelloFresh.com/SmokingTire14. That's HelloFresh.com/SmokingTire14 and use code SmokingTire14. So you got to do it twice. You got to do HelloFresh.com/SmokingTire14 and then use code SmokingTire14 for up to 14 free meals and 3 free gifts. HelloFresh is America's number one meal kit. All right, on this episode of the podcast, Mr. Ed Justice Jr. is in studio. Ed is a photographer, a motorsports historian, and a member of the Justice Brothers family of car care products. They do oils, they do parts, they do all kinds of things. They have a car museum. We talk about the history of Ed's family in racing. His family was the first ever business to sponsor a NASCAR driver, going way back. We talk about IndyCar. We talk about some of the more iconic photographs he took. Evel Knievel doing crazy stunts. It's a really interesting conversation with a very interesting person. Ed Justice Jr. is on the Smoking Tire podcast. are optional. Your hair is really nice. I don't want to
thank you very much.
Really,
I use our gear oil treatment.
You really, really got the Pat Riley thing going on with that.
Yeah,
with the
well,
hair
you
there.
Know what? It's been tested up to 125 miles
it's
an hour.
It's aerodynamic, right?
Yeah, in this direction. It, yeah. It fails that direction.
The Santa
about,
Ana
about
winds
35.
Really gets
it's
you.
Like, it's
right?
like a cam back.
Yeah. Right? Way, it's know? Like the trees in yeah. Venice Beach. As long as the wind is going one way, you're in good yep. shape. When it flips around, it's a
people
real problem.
People think I spend a lot of time on my hair, but that's the furthest thing from the truth, to be quite honest. But
I bet you could do that in about 15 seconds with your yeah. level of experience.
Yeah, exactly right. As a trained hair expert.
So we are.
I take
we're
inventory
now,
every morning.
We're now in. We are in the show. This is it.
Okay.
No, we don't do formal. I do a formal intro over there when you're not around. Not yeah. wasting your time. Thanks for coming down though. It's a pleasure
great
to see
be
you.
Here. Yeah. You know I
you're a great follow on Instagram.
Well, thank you very much.
I love your Instagram. I look forward
well,
to your
thank you.
To your history drops every single
well,
day.
Well, you know, I only do it just for that. I'm not saying that. I mean, anytime somebody tells me that, that's the only reason I do it.
Yeah.
You know, when I the whole social media thing is interesting to me in that I had a Twitter account. I just signed up for one. I never used it. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden my son-in-law said, wow, you know, you should go on Twitter. You know, this, that. And then what was the seminal moment for me was when the Marines or whatever the special forces were that took out Obama. I mean, Osama bin Laden.
Yeah,
under Obama. When there was some guy across the street from the compound in Pakistan.
Yeah, tweeting
and he goes,
about it.
Yeah, he goes, hey, there's something really big happening across the road here.
Yeah.
That was a moment for me that said, wow, traditional news media is really got a problem here.
I mean, I get a lot of my world news in rapid fire from Twitter. But I like Instagram because I like photography. I was a photography major in college.
Yeah.
And so I like looking at other people's photographs and whatever. And I mean, you are, and I want to go into a lot of your history, but you know, you're a historical photographer, a motorsport photographer, but your family has so much history
right.
that especially unconstrained with the longer form of Instagram writing, you can get, you know, a few hundred words in there.
Yeah.
I bang on that.
I mean,
you're able to put it in context.
And I continued below is very
right.
Like I did the deal on Frank Williams the other day. You know, I wanted to do a nice tribute on the guy because it really, really sort of hit home because I had an uncle who was in a wheelchair, as I said on that post and all that. And you know, I just start writing, and I try to be concise, you know, but then all of a sudden I go to post it and it says your post is too long, so then I got to go back up and I got
to
figure out
how
where
much to cut.
Yeah, right.
Well, what you got? Do you do it on your phone? You type it on your phone?
I do, or I'll do it on my iPad.
If you do it from your computer, it shows you words remaining, so you can
really?
Know. Yeah, so you don't have to do that. You could if you do it from your computer, it shows you how much room you got left.
Well, I type it in notes.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, because it's so much easier to proofread.
I know.
Because you know how the cycle of doing that stuff. It's no grand plan. I mean, you know,
it shouldn't be.
No,
it's Instagram.
And
you're not writing.
You know,
you're not doing a 500 page.
It was actually
book.
Robert Angelo that got me to really kick in on my Instagram account. And you know, he did Jay Leno's Garage for years.
Oh yeah, I do know. I know that guy. Yeah,
Emmy award winning.
Yes, I do.
And
know
Robert, he does independent stuff now. And he was the one that actually, after we did a video project together, said to me, Ed, Instagram was made for a guy like you.
Well, you have such an archive to work from.
Yeah, it's amazing.
You know, you don't, even if you never shot a new frame as long as you lived, you'd still have a lifetime of Instagram.
And beyond.
And there's other folks that I follow as well who are sort of, they're maybe a little more brand specific. There's obviously a bunch of Porsche folks. There's a few Ferrari folks that go into the 50s and 60s,
right.
And they've got all these historical archives. But it's a great, especially if you're into cars and racing, it's a great medium.
Yeah, it is. It's unbelievable. And, you know, on my Instagram feed, which is my primary feed, like you're talking, it's reposted on Twitter, and it'll repost on Facebook. And then after that, I'm done. Okay? I try to encourage people to take one bite of every part of the apple when it comes to the car and racing world. Mm-hmm. You know, I meet people, they go, ah, I don't like NASCAR, or I don't like IndyCar, or I don't like Formula One, or I don't like sports car. You know, I don't like whatever. And it's said in a way that they're never going to see it. Or I don't like drag racing, or, you know, whatever it is. Or I only like this.
Yeah.
And I try to encourage them, you know, you've never been to a NASCAR race? Go to one.
Yeah.
Okay, go to one. And if you don't like it,
I bet most people who say they don't like NASCAR would find a way to have a pretty good time at a race.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, my life has been every form of motorsport known to mankind. I was raised that way. I've been in it. And so I try. The only thing that I really work on when it comes to my posts on Instagram is I try to bounce around. Mm-hmm. I don't do, like, 4 IndyCar posts in a row or 2, or I try to go, okay, IndyCar, let's go to F1 now.
Well, you find a way to make it connected somehow to whatever's going on in a current events, which I like.
You know, I was down at Sunday, and I went to the new Myers Manx building.
Cool. Yeah. They're building Myers Manxes again.
Right. And they're getting the building done.
I hear they're doing a pretty good job at it, too,
They had a wall of bodies stacked up, and Freeman Thomas, who's the chief CEO, you know, is a very good friend of mine, and, you know, he's a former designer at Ford.
Legendary.
Right. And he worked at Porsche, and he's the Audi TT was mm-hmm. his design, and he helped on the new Volkswagen and et cetera. Yeah, super good guy. And they're having fun down there. They really are. And
they did a real big media push around Pebble Beach. They flew that Albatross airplane up to Pebble Beach.
So cool.
And the Manxes are there. I mean, it's such a California thing, you know, the story of Bruce Myers.
Yeah.
And
I did that post on Bruce, and because they had an SR down there that Stuart Reed, who is the transportation department chair at Art Center, and I hadn't seen an SR in person in years, and I shot a picture of it, and that's what prompted me to do that post. And what I found was the feedback, it's instantaneous, as you well know. And people right away, they go, wow, you know, the Manx and the image that little car has around the world is phenomenal.
Well, it says so much about California and California cars.
Totally.
Because you've got the Volkswagen thing, which was, with the hippies and all that, was a very California thing.
Yep.
You've got modifying and coach building,
right,
which as far as Americans are concerned is a California thing. You've got the connection to old cars, open top, you know, driving on the beach. It's like everything about it is just California.
Free spirit.
Yeah, totally.
You know, the first one was built in Bruce Meyer's garage on Lido Island, and when you think about that, I mean, it's just the whole thing about it is pretty cool. So that's what prompted that post.
I hear they've got a lot of orders for these new ones. I hear people are really into it, and they got a bunch of orders.
I would believe that. I would not have a problem believing that at all. And what I think is so cool, and I said it to the group down there, is that they were able to consummate the purchase of the company, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the rights from Bruce Myers while he was still alive.
Yeah.
And so it went totally with his blessing, his knowledge. And while it would have been okay if he had passed and they bought it from his wife, it was so much better, in my opinion, that he was so happy. He got to see that the car was going to live.
Yeah.
And you also got his stamp of approval.
And he gets to enjoy some of the money while he's still around, I hope.
You know what? I bought a car from a 94-year-old guy one time, and after he saw where the car was going to go in our collection and all that, he gave me a few thousand off, unprompted by me. I didn't say, hey. Yeah. But you know what?
You got to love when they negotiate against themselves.
Yeah, Bruce Myers passed at 94. And when I bought that car from the 94-year-old guy and he gave me the discount, I said, well, what's he going to do with the money? The guy was already financially secure. I said, he's not going to Vegas and spending it on a good time.
Well, maybe he's relieving his family members of the burden of having to deal with it, because that can certainly
happen. Well, there's a long story behind that, and that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that was a big part of it.
Just because the one person is into collecting cars doesn't mean the people that they they leave behind are into disposing of, and it can, of all
it
of
can,
those
it
cars.
It can be a burden, burden for yeah. a lot of people.
Yeah, we see that happening. You know, we store collector cars here, and there is a
you have a front row seat.
We got we get quite a few cars that come in from people who were left the car.
Yeah,
you know, and they don't know what to do with it. Maybe they want to drive it, but most likely they don't. They just want to make sure it's safe, and you know it can be a challenge. You know, some people are very happy to have their dead parents' car. Other people are like, wait, I have to pay to store this thing now, but I don't want to sell it, and blah blah blah. So it can be a real thing. But what do you think about, just to finish off on Myers Manx, compared to, let's say, a Shelby, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a Shelby continuation car versus an original CSX car. What do you see happening to a Myers Manx in terms of being accepted by the community, valued appropriately, being built during this modern era versus one that was built under the stewardship of Bruce himself?
You know, that's a really interesting question. Because I think it's totally different than like a Shelby or whatever. I think the Manx, because it's so basic, that I don't think there's going to be an issue. And I mean, at the end of the day,
because they are copied, there's knockoff Manxes around,
totally,
a bunch of them.
Some of them that are a dead copy, and others that copied back in the day that were somebody else's idea. It is truly, without a doubt, I think the claim has been made, and I think it's probably true. Without a doubt, the most copied car ever built.
You think more than the Cobra?
Oh.
I think the Cobra.
Yeah.
Really, I would make an argument for the Cobra.
No, because Bruce Myers sued people, but not with the aggressive nature that Carroll Shelby did.
Okay.
You know, I mean, Carroll Shelby had a very well-known reputation of suing everybody.
Yeah. Okay? He would put you out of business.
Yeah. And, I mean, Dan Gurney made a quote at his memorial at the Peterson Museum that was the absolute quote of the day. And it was written by his wife, and that was, when they said they made Carroll Shelby, they only made one and broke the mold, because if they had made a second one, he would have sued them.
That's hilarious.
That's really funny. You know what? Yeah, that was so the line funny. Of the day.
Yeah, I bet you got standing O for that.
Yeah, because it was so true. So I mean, you know, Carroll was very litigious.
Yeah.
I met his attorney one time. He happened
to
work.
That's someone I'd like to get on the podcast. Carroll Shelby's lawyer.
Yeah, he actually worked at a firm that we dealt with, and I was walking down the hallway one day, and the guy says, "Hey, Ed, you'd like to meet this guy," and he introduces me, and he goes, "Yeah, he was an attorney for Carroll Shelby." And I was like, "Oh, really?
Busy man."
Yeah, one client. You built your home, huh? You know. So anyway,
that's
awesome. Some people use the court systems a lot more aggressively than others.
Well, I think it's fun. It's funny that that's one of Carroll Shelby's legacies. But you know, if you build something and other people just start building and selling the same thing, I mean, what are you going to do? You know what I mean?
But you have to really, if you're smart. Like at the end of the day, Bruce Myers said that it was a waste of money.
It could be true.
And there's another non-automotive, the guy who invented the Pet Rock. Okay.
Yeah.
Which was the hottest selling thing one Christmas. And every, you know, how hard was it to rip off the Pet Rock? You go out, you know, go out to Irwindale, okay? Yeah. They got Pet Rocks laying everywhere, all right?
They
and
got
you
a
put
whole
it in a little cardboard
them.
Box with a little deal and copy the deal. And the guy said, I've read this in a book that he was featured in. He said, you know what? I spent thousands of dollars. Maybe 100, 200, I forget what it was. And by next Christmas, nobody wanted to buy my gift anyway. And so what did I really protect?
Yeah, yeah.
So a lot of times you really have to weigh.
Guy should have just been happy that he pulled one over on everybody and said, okay, thank you, sir. Good night. I'll be on an island somewhere.
Yeah, you got to give the guy credit. He was an advertising copywriter, you know. And it was a little booklet that sold The Rock, you know.
Yeah, amazing.
You know, you teach it. They've all been taught to sit, You know, and you know he had all the lines. He was great, but anyway,
my wife was in the toy business.
So really?
She really knows about the history of really bizarre toys that probably should never have made it, but did.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a fickle business, but anyway, you know, Carol, there's a million stories about Carol Shelby, and I mean everybody's got one, and I knew Carol real well, and when people say, well, hey, what type of a guy was he? All I ever can really say to anybody is, to me, he was a great guy, okay? He was always great. When I was doing road and track radio, car and driver, whatever, Carol would always come on. I interviewed him numerous times at live events and all. And, you know, I always treated him with respect because Carol deserved the respect. I mean, he's a legend. And he was always very thankful and all that. But that's with the caveat, I never did business with Carol.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
And had I crossed into that realm, then my experience may have been different.
Sure.
Who knows?
But I met him once. He was very nice to me.
Yeah.
I was a total stranger, nobody, and he was very, very nice to
me.
He
could charm a snake.
Yeah.
Yeah, he could charm
and
a snake.
And sometimes did.
Yup. Big time. I mean, you know.
What did you think of Ford versus Ferrari?
Yeah.
What did you think of the film? You think it was accurate or?
Well, let's face it. Look at, I mean, come on.
It wasn't as inaccurate as it could be.
At least Hollywood, unlike media, at least Hollywood, when they misrepresent the facts, they can use the clause artistic license.
Sure.
Okay?
Yeah.
And let's face it, sometimes they need to have artistic license.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I mean, if he's shifting the car 36 times going down the straightaway, okay, it's a lot
Isn't
more.
Isn't it funny how there's always room to downshift in a race car?
You're never too close to the race line to go down. Yeah, looking over at your fellow competitor at 200.
Yeah, we just do that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, so here's the thing, though. I was out in front of a coffee shop one day, and a guy was saying, hey, you know my neighbor, she's 85. She didn't plan on going to see Ford versus Ferrari, but it was the only thing that she hit the time right or something, whatever. Yeah. She ended up in the theater to see it. And he goes, she loved it.
Yeah.
Okay, so on that basis, I say it was a great film.
Sure.
Okay?
Because it appealed brought that story to
A broader audience,
yeah.
Okay? And it engaged people. It's like this deal on Netflix about Formula One. It's had a tremendous...
Drive to Survive.
Yeah, it's
I
had a tremendous effect on people's interest in Formula One.
Yeah, and it has made the races within the race much more. I mean, the main coverage of the race, they never talk about the battle for seventh.
No.
You know what I mean? They don't talk about the life story of
right.
the drivers that are mid-pack. Like, I would have never heard of a third of the drivers on the grid if not for Drive to Survive. And because of that show, I care about those drivers now. So
I wish Drive to Survive would do every race as an episode, because they can make the most boring F1 race exciting, because they crank up the whoa when a car goes by.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, look, they're juicing the story. But boy, it sure makes it compelling. I love it.
Motorsports coverage is really hard, because you never know what's going to happen, where it's going to happen, when it's going to happen. And it's just so difficult to cover everything all the time.
Well, you know, in the day when they wouldn't do the Indy 500 live, and my dad and I, literally right after the race, we'd be on a jet coming back to L.A., and we'd get back in time almost to watch the race from the start on the delay.
Uh-huh.
And when I'd try to do it, always about, you know, three quarters of the way through, because I'm just so beat from the day,
from
early
the actual
morning.
Race.
And, yeah, but, you know, when that back in that day, when they did that, and they knew who won, they would go back and edit the race coverage appropriately.
Oh.
Okay. And Bobby and Sam Posey, they'd go, boy, look at Cheever. He's sure making inroads coming up through the field. That's a fact.
That's very interesting.
So they'd
point
out
what would happen at the end, they
absolutely.
Would narrate it.
Oh, yeah. They'd go back and
because they do that in Drive to Survive.
Wow. Right.
In Drive to Survive, they have some, like, it sounds like announcing,
right.
but it's really voiceover
right.
focusing on
right.
that.
Right, right,
yeah.
right. Yeah,
How
no, they
funny.
Used to do that a lot. And it really made for a great broadcast.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you know, they go, wow, Cheever, you know, like the year Cheever won. Cheever just missed that because he had a few close calls in that race that at any given moment would have ended his day.
Yeah.
And so if they caught those, they'd point, hey, look at that. Wow, he just really made it. Boy, what a race today,
Sam. That's
interesting.
You know? Will they do that with other sports too?
I don't know.
I mean, to go back to, because you know, you see videos of old sports and you listen to, but to go back and I think like re-watch that stuff with the frame of mind of, hey, this announcing happened after they knew who won. That's a very interesting way to like reframe the coverage.
Yeah, they used to do that. It was interesting. I'll tell you, I've gone to...
What was the first Indy 500 you went to?
Actually, in person was 1977, AJ's fourth win, and we were working with AJ, so I was there. And that's 45 races since then, consecutive for me.
Been every single one?
Yes.
In 45 years?
For our family, we've been involved at the race ever since the first race after World War II, 1946, which is 75 of the 105 run.
That's amazing.
Yeah, they say we hold the record for longest. There's another family, the Agajanian family.
Of course.
They came on the scene, JC, like 2-3 years later.
You know Jacob? Jacob Agajanian?
Yeah,
he's a good friend.
Yeah, yeah.
Race service. Yeah, he's been on the show too.
Yeah, yeah.
Legendary family.
Yeah. Well, we sponsored the Granatelli brothers. See, we won in 50, we won the race the first time. And with Johnny Parsons with Frank Curtis' car.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 52, I mean, we sponsored 51. Then 52, we sponsored the Granatelli brothers' car with Jim Rathman. That car finished second. The car that won was the Agajanian Troy Ruttman car. And I always have fun with them. I tell them, you know, there was a scoring discrepancy, you know. But anyway, but
still litigating
years later. But anyway, there's a picture of me that I gave you at Indy this year, because we ended up winning this year. It's I think maybe
all the way to the top.
Right there,
there you go. There he is.
So that's during the race this year. Okay, of course. Last year, we know they ran the race, but it was run late, no spectators, mm-hmm. and the COVID protocol was off the charts. What's amazing about this picture is this is shot with my iPhone. Now, iPhones are great for selfies.
Yeah.
Okay? They're like a lot of things today. The photos you make with an iPhone are like some of the clothing you buy. Yeah, it's good for a while, and then you throw it away.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I wanted to...
Photos taken on an iPhone look good on an iPhone.
That's it. But don't ever want nice print later.
Right.
Despite what
Apple billboards will tell
right.
you.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, I shot this picture because at that time, I put it on Instagram and talking about the race and whatever. And what is amazing about this picture is right over my shoulder there. That car is the car we end up winning with, Elio Castro Neves. Now,
did you time that intentionally, or was that an accidental shot?
Buddy, I wish I could say I was that good.
Wow, that's awesome.
Okay, with an iPhone, you don't get that good, all right? I mean, that car's going like 220, okay? All right?
I mean, actually, now that I think about it, that's a very fast shutter speed for an iPhone to capture that little of a blur at that speed.
It really is.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I go out and I shoot pictures with, I got a Sony pocket camera that fits in your palm.
Yeah.
And I went out to one of the races at Laguna Seca, and I also did it at Road Atlanta. And to prove that I could actually just take that camera
mm-hmm.
that has like a 200 millimeter lens zoom and cover a race, particularly for online, and nobody would ever know the difference.
I bet they didn't.
Yeah. I mean, you know, because it's if you know how to set it,
yeah.
et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, going from my 50-plus years of experience, yeah, you can do it. And but I've tried to do that with an iPhone. Yeah, it's impossible. Just not happening.
At a certain point, you need real glass.
Yeah.
If
you go to the top picture here, the Evel Knievel, okay? So that was shot...
You shot that?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
See, we're looking at Evel Knievel jumping a bunch of really terrible-looking cars.
Datsuns
with a Confederate flag flying in the background. Where is this? Is this Vegas?
Ontario.
Oh, okay.
That's the San Gabriel Mountains.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah,
and Mount...
is that Mount Baldy back
yeah,
there?
Yeah, Mount Baldy would be to your right.
Yeah.
And
we drive on those roads every single week back there.
Yeah, exactly right. Going to Newcomb's Ranch, et cetera.
And he's got to jump in a bunch of Datsuns and a Dodge van. Or maybe it's a Ford van. Yeah,
I hope he's on his way up because the van's at the end.
Yeah, well,
you know what I mean?
Looks like he might not clear that if he's on his way down.
I shot Evil a number of times. And the first time I got to photograph Evil was at the L.A. Sports Arena, which was next to the Coliseum. Mm-hmm. Tiny venue by today's standards, but the Lakers played there years back. And he jumped outside, and he was riding an American Eagle motorcycle at that time. And he had not stepped up to the Harley yet. And it's funny, I've got other shots of this from that day, but this jump, he landed perfectly and all that. And as I was going home on, and I had the radio, news radio on, you know, one of the ones here in L.A., and they said that he had to lay the bike down and barely made the jump and all that. And I go, wow, the press agent really got to him. It's just amazing. So, I mean, look at Evil. When Robbie jumped at Caesar's Palace, I called up Jerry Foyt, AJ's youngest son, and Davy Jones, who was driving for Jaguar at the time in the IMSA GTP, and I said, hey, you guys want to go see Robbie jump the Palace Fountains? Now, Jerry knew Evil because Evil used to come around AJ's suite at Indy, and so I said, I'll get the passes. I'll get us in. And you got, yeah. So we all converged, got a rental car and spent the day with Evil and watched Robbie. And of course, Robbie, this bike here had zero suspension give.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like trying to jump a 18 wheeler. I mean, thing is boom.
Yeah.
And most of the time when Evil crashed, like Caesar's Palace,
it
was the rebound.
And then go down, right?
Yeah, it was the rebound from the tire that kicked him off the motorcycle.
This is heavy bike.
Yeah.
It's
and,
like,
you know, I mean, when Robbie jumped the Palace, they had a landing ramp, but he, in his practice jumps out at the airport earlier in the day, he was landing on flat pavement.
What?
Oh, yeah, because, you know, the compression and the, he'd jump the deal and land on flat. You don't
and
even.
He'd be okay?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Well, it's like Robbie Madison when he did the arch deal.
Yeah.
That drop, I mean, you think about that. That's just, to me, that was an amazing deal. I mean, there's a lot of people that have come along. And
well, they now have the stadium super trucks that hit these jumps and land flat.
Yeah.
So they can do it with the right suspension. But on a motorcycle, to do a big jump and is gnarly.
I mean,
if you don't have I remember that jump when he went straight down off that thing.
I mean,
I remember that.
You know what?
That was wild.
I couldn't even begin to tell you what I would think if you roll to the edge of that thing and you're looking at that.
Yeah, didn't he go up and then down, right?
Yeah.
He went up the Arc de Triomphe, flipped around, and then came down.
Yeah, yeah, came back
gnarly.
Down.
Yeah.
I mean,
that was crazy.
That is epic.
Yeah, here he goes. We got the video. Hopefully we don't get flagged for this. We could, in our opinion, that's how you can avoid getting flagged. Yeah, up, flat land it, and then come on down, Robbie.
Yeah, that's his wife, and she's saying,
make sure to show the very cute girl looking scared.
No, thank you for buying that insurance policy prior to this jump.
That look he just takes right there, just straight off the edge.
Is there a point where you go, you know, oh blank?
Some people don't have it, though. Some, like Travis, they just don't,
have it. I love... They've got the strobes that are rapid firing, so it looks like people are shooting pictures.
Yeah.
And I think it's a great effect.
It is a good effect.
I'm not
effect.
Knocking it. I just think it adds a lot of excitement. I mean, you know, because when a guy like this does this today, I think there's too many people are like, oh, well, he did that. No big deal. Because he's so talented, it makes it look easy.
Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, yeah, okay, well. Well, he's going to do it twice the height. Okay, well, whatever. You know, I mean, but this is unbelievable. I mean, I've never met Robbie Madison, but I got to tell you something. I take my hat off to this guy.
Oh, that's a gnarly drop. What's crazy about that is he was going 5.
Yeah.
He does. It's not like he hits this ramp at 100. He goes off the cliff at 5 and almost overshoots it.
His front tire lands on the flat.
He almost overshoots.
I mean,
it's wild.
Yeah. So anyway, but seeing Evil, you know, because look at Evil was really one of the first, maybe not the first, but seeing that whole thing, I mean,
did you see any of his like Snake River, like rocket?
No, I didn't
ship
go
stuff?
To that. I didn't go to that. And You know, the big question on the Snake River is, had that chute not deployed, and the, boy, there's all sorts of conspiracies on that. Had it not deployed, how would he have landed that thing? I think that's a viable question, but anyway, so.
The Snake River stuff to me seems really off the wall.
Well, you know what? Even with the chute deploying, when that sky cycle came down and it bumped into the side of the canyon there, had it been cow side into the canyon,
it would have just crushed him.
That's it. I mean, seriously, that's not, I mean,
it wasn't nearly as thought through as it seems.
That thing had a lot of ways to go bad.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And he was just lucky that it didn't go. But, you know, I think that was the largest watched episode on Wide World of Sports. And second, as I remember, was his jump at Wembley Stadium.
Uh-huh.
You know, that he did. But
that,
you know,
yeah, to call that a sky cycle, that's basically a plane without any wings.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, look at the picture. It's like open, you know, cockpit. It doesn't even have
you'll get a lot of opinions on a fellow like Evel Knievel. But one thing is for sure, it takes a special person to strap into a deal like that and say,
oh, yeah,
hit it.
Well, he had something, you know, that was really...
He was willing to go the distance.
He never backed down from any of that crazy stuff. And I'm not sure if that's an admirable quality or just a bad one.
You know, there's a videotape out, and you might be able to find it online, called Evel Knievel's Greatest Hits, which is a great title in itself, okay?
And could be read both ways.
It's crash after crash with his narration, and it is... I get the biggest kick out of watching it. Having been there and seen some of it and having known Evel, you know, to a degree, and him talking about, you know, he had an anti-drug message and, you know, positive thinking is great to have when you do stuff like this. But when things go wrong at the other end of the ramp, you got to have more than positive thinking, you know.
I mean, yeah.
You know, like when you crash.
You need drugs.
Yeah, when you crash and all that. But then Gary Wells, Gary Wells did the Caesar's Palace jump, you might remember, and he didn't end so well. He crashed, and as he separated from the bike, he slammed into an embutment in the underground parking and ripped his chest open.
Oh, I do.
And there was a doctor there that literally saved his life, ran over to him. Well, we were going to a motorcycle show in Vegas shortly thereafter, like a couple weeks, maybe a week. And Mike Bass, the Speedway rider who we sponsored, was with us. And I said to Mike and my dad, I said, let's go to the hospital and let's go visit Gary and go see. And so we go in the hospital and we go in the room and, hey, Gary, how you doing and all that. And he's all, I want to do that jump again. I'm not joking. I think Gary's still alive, and he would verify that. He goes, I want to do that jump again. If they'll let me do that jump, I want to do that jump again. Of course, they said, no, we're done on the jump thing now. You know, it's not working out so well. So when Robbie did the jump, it was a big deal, and that was like a one and done deal. And because it had changed a lot since Evel jumped. I mean, they had developed the landing area.
Yeah.
Because it was wide open when Evel did it. You know, and it's just like Vegas, the Strip, it's New York City now. And
yeah, there's just not room for that kind of stuff.
No.
But do you think Robbie had the thing that Evel had, or do you think he just really wanted out of that shadow?
I don't
or
know.
Or a part of it, or to earn the name that people assumed he had.
I think Robbie was an incredibly talented guy. I mean, he did that other jump from the top of one jockey club to the other, high-rise building.
Ooh.
Jump to jump.
Ooh. I think there was some genetic in there, because Pastrana's dad has, like, done backflips
you
and
know,
stuff.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Pastrana doesn't seem like he feels pain or anything. He's amazing.
No. You know, yeah. I sponsored a couple of those extreme motocross guys. And most of those sponsorships don't last very long because they end up with a broken hip or broken pelvis. I mean, both of the guys that I was working with, I mean, it wasn't that long and they were really seriously hurt.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's just no...
That's why those guys end up in rally cars eventually.
Yeah,
with age,
I mean,
comes a cage.
And I mean, you know, they keep pushing the limit. So where is the limit on this stuff?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just, where is the limit? But anyway,
the next
more power
thing.
To
it's
them.
Always the
you know
next
what? They're
thing.
Doing what they want to do, and God bless them.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
And they become decent rally drivers once they get too hurt.
Well, motorcycling is a great entree for any form of four-wheel racing.
For sure. You learn weight transfer.
And dirt.
Yeah.
You know, Kenny Roberts, when we gave Kenny Roberts the Justice Brothers Shav Glick Award, which we do every year at the the NASCAR race at Fontana, named after the L.A. Times sports writer Shav Glick, who was a legend, very good guy to auto racing. And Kenny Roberts got it 1 year, and Kenny told me, because I ended up spending the day with him, he said he had a training school up in Central California. He's moved from that area now, but I think he still trains riders. And he said he'd get riders from outside the country, and they want to be a Grand Prix rider because, you know, he won the big Grand Prix, mm-hmm. you know, like Rossi, Valentino,
yeah,
and all
MotoGP,
that. Right.
Whatever it was
and
called.
And so anyway, you know, Kenny was just a, you know, why they call him King Kenny, you know, phenomenal racer. And he goes, I take him out, and we're going to start on dirt. And a lot of times, you know, in whatever foreign dialect they might have, no, I don't want to do dirt. And he goes, no, we start dirt. No, you don't understand. We signed up to become Grand Prix racers.
Yeah.
It's a pavement. And he goes, no, we start on dirt. Everybody starts on dirt. I started on dirt. Everybody starts on dirt. And the reason why is he wants you to become used to the bike slipping.
Yeah.
So when it happens on
Works
pavement,
cars
you
too.
Don't... Oh, my God. Right. You know, yeah.
Same thing in cars.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
right.
We tell a lot of people, because they ask us about driving schools, what driving school should we go to? And we always say, go to a rally school first.
Yeah, exactly.
You come out with so much knowledge about car control.
You know, Jimmy Johnson, who we sponsored it back in this era of the stadiums and all that, mm-hmm. and we worked with him a lot with the Chevrolet program, that was his dirt experience was off-road in stadium truck.
Yeah.
And so... you know, when people say, well, you know, how did Jimmy, I go, look at, you got to look, he spent time on dirt.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, Ray Evernham told me one time, cause he's a big midget fan. And, you know, in our collection, we've got more midget race cars, small dirt based, they can run on pavement too, but very only American type racing. That's also big in parts of Europe and Australia.
We've
and New
recently
Zealand.
Heard about some European sprint midget racing.
Yeah.
It's
so anyway,
very interesting.
But
wings are even bigger than the ones we have here.
Yeah, the wings. Yeah, they did make it more drivable. But anyway, Ray told me, he said, I would, if I ever did another NASCAR team, which he has no plans to do, I'm sure. But he said, I would only hire somebody that had midget experience. And Jeff Gordon was one of those. Tony Stewart was another one. Casey Kane, mm-hmm. Kyle Larson, who just won the championship this year, because it gives them such a seat of the pants feel.
Right.
You know what I mean? And, you know, when I was running a go-kart for fun, you know, you can get these grippy, I think the grippy compound was double E. And that thing, I mean, it's just... It's like glue on the track, but you don't learn much when you do that.
No, motion is good.
Yeah.
That's why we like. That's why you know, even just in our new car reviews, we just drove the new Toyota 86, right?
Yeah.
And you can get it on the Prius tires, or you can get it on Pilot Sport 4S tires as an option. And so my recommendation was if you're going to go to the track, get it on the Prius tires.
Yeah.
So it moves around you, yep. and you learn something. And then when you're on the street, get it on the 4S tires so you have a little more grip.
Yeah, with that.
But you want it to move on the track. That's where the fun happens.
Yeah.
That's where the knowledge happens.
You know, there's a scene in one of the James Bond films. Was it Diamonds Are Forever or whatever, where that Bond drives the Mustang
the
down the alleyway in Vegas.
Yeah.
Well, Buzz Bundy was the guy that did that, and Buzz was a friend of ours. He worked for the Joey Chitwood stunt school, and there's some pictures in our book, The Legacy
Ed
of Justice.
Us this book, go to camera four there, The Legacy of Justice, An American Family Story. It's 500 pages of words and incredible photographs about Ed's entire family history in racing and motorsports in California. It is awesome. I can't wait to get into it deep. Thank you for bringing
it. Thank you.
Appreciate
it. Yeah, in that, you know, there's a whole segment on Chitwood because my dad and uncles were his first sponsor with the Thrill Show.
Mm-hmm.
And so Buzz Bundy, though, told me on that ski driving, he said the cheaper tires have better sidewall.
Oh, yeah, harder sidewalls. Yeah.
Lasting.
Yeah.
He said, I don't buy the good tires. And he said, because the cheaper ones actually work well when you're driving on
that makes sense.
Yeah, on the edge.
That Mustang, have you been over to the Peterson? You seen the Bond exhibit?
No, I haven't.
That Mustang's in it.
Is it?
Yeah,
Mustang. It's a yellow okra or whatever.
It's got some weird stripe on the side of it. That, if you haven't been, I can't recommend it highly enough. It, not only if you're
a
Bond
blew me
fan,
away.
But
a
car fan, too.
I was there
at
the gala the other night, but I didn't get to see it.
Yeah.
And but what blew me away is down when you're walking into the museum, they've got that helicopter.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, that's from the 60s.
Yeah.
I think that was from Goldfinger.
It's, it is, I believe, Goldfinger.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they have the other helicopter. That was one of them. I forget which one. But if you go in the exhibit, they've got the other one. It's a helicopter chase. And there's the Bond helicopter and then the bad guy helicopter. And they have both.
When I saw that one down in the parking area, I go, so who kept this helicopter?
Yeah.
I mean... Yeah. Somebody must have a storage facility like you for keeping helicopters.
Well, because in that whole exhibit, there's a whole bunch of weird shit that people have kept. It's like, what do you even do with this thing?
Seriously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, movie memorabilia in Hollywood.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I don't know if the auction has happened yet. Can you see if the Mad Max auction's happened yet? You know, the Mad Max Fury Road?
Oh, really?
They're auctioning off like 30 vehicles from the movie.
What?
And the owner, has the auction happened yet? It was listed in September. When is this happening?
Oh, wow. Yeah, this is great stuff.
The seller is the fucking director. He kept all of them himself.
Oh.
He kept all the vehicles himself. He's like, I'll take that one.
Well, you know what?
Dean
Jeffries told me some stories because Dean was a good friend. And, you know, he made the Monkey Mobile. He made the original Green Hornet Black Beauty. And
with George Barris. Right?
No.
I thought George Barris was involved in that.
No, well, that's a lot of people. anyway.
Long story.
George would put those pictures up on his building and all that. Dean Jeffries Automotive Styling, if you watch the Monkees, if you go on and you find an old Monkees episode, go to the credits at the end and it'll say Monkey Mobile by Dean Jeffries Automotive Styling. Yeah. No, Dean did the Monkey Mobile. He did the Green Hornet, original Black Beauty. He did the trolley car and Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Uh-huh.
He did the Mercedes from Spaceballs.
I love that one.
I own that.
The fuck out of here.
Yeah.
You own Princess Vespa's Mercedes?
God. You actually know the car.
No way.
Princess Vespa.
Yeah. You're not an Mister. This is a Mercedes.
Yeah.
You own that?
Mercedes gave it a designation too, by the way.
It's a 5000 SEL or something like that, isn't it?
Yeah, they gave it a designation.
I am like a Spaceballs nerd.
Huge.
I am a huge Spaceballs nerd.
Ludicrous speed, buddy.
I was Barf for Halloween a couple years ago.
Oh, really?
Ago. Yeah. It was awesome.
You know, it's the funniest thing.
I can't believe you own that. That rules.
You know what? Some people come to see our collection, and they go through, and they'll go, oh, yeah, this is really impressive. This is really impressive. And then we get to that Spaceballs Mercedes, and they go, oh, my God. You got to shoot a picture of me with this. I mean, everything else.
Is the collection open? Is
it
a museum? Can people come see it?
Okay, so there's the front of it. See there on the left?
Oh, yeah.
That's the front of it. it is open to the public, free.
Where is it?
It's in Duarte, California.
Really? Why have I not seen it? I need to go. I think I need to go to...
You got
to
come on out.
So much time there last year.
There you go. This is shot a few years ago.
There it is. He's got the picture of it right here. That's the Spaceballs Mercedes.
I should probably...
That's so funny.
And it runs.
What? It runs. Oh
yeah, I've driven it.
What's underneath it?
It's got a little Ford motor.
It does?
Yeah,
it's
and
so
it's rear steer.
Oh, really?
So it looks like a, I tell people, is that a hovercraft? I go, yeah, it's a Hollywood hovercraft.
Well,
like that's a Hollywood New York building.
In the movie, it has to do sort of a little drift maneuver. So
yeah,
maybe
I don't
they
remember.
It
it's been a while since I've seen the movie. But
rules.
Well, you know what? I said to him one day, I said, Dean, I'd like to really have something that you built and all that. And I should have bought his van, too, at the time, because he couldn't give this darn Dodge van away that he made a ramp in the back. And
what was it for?
Going out to the movie sets and working.
Oh, it was a work van. Oh, that'd be cool.
And he could haul stuff in it. And he did a full Jeffries treatment, painted it, striped it. You know, the whole nine yards. And you know, at the time I thought, man, whatever. What am I going to do with this van?
Yeah.
So, but anyway, so he goes, well, I've got that. And I go, okay, yeah, I'll take it. Yeah, that's sort of cool. And
it's really
not,
cool.
Not realizing that this movie would become such a cultural icon.
Yeah. How long ago did he give this thing to you?
Like, oh God, it's been a while. So anyway, so after Spaceballs, he would rent it out for TV commercials and stuff, uh-huh. whatever. Set it in the background of something or whatever. And so after I bought it, he'd call me up and he'd go, hey, they're interested in maybe renting that vehicle. And he goes, you want to do that? And I go, God, I don't. He goes, look, if you don't want to do it, just tell me. He says, I know it's a pain in the rear end. And he goes, you know, I get it. And, you know, he goes, you know, sometimes you can negotiate a good deal. Other times they want to pay
price it high enough that it's worth
or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And I go, well, you know, Dean, it's sort of, I mean, I'm running the business here and I got a million other things going. And he goes, okay, no problem. I'll never call again. Don't worry about it. And he meant it in a nice way. And
yeah,
I said,
yeah,
okay, I'm good with that. He goes, yeah, I'll just tell him, forget it. It's not for being use or whatever. But
how amazing that it actually drives, though. I would have never guessed that is an actual operating automobile.
So cool.
That rules. What else? What are some of your other favorites in the collection?
Well, you know, wow, it's hard to really. It's like trying to pick kids. That dragster right there is a very cool car. That was on the cover of the December 1958 Carcraft magazine, and that is, a lot of people say is that the Glass Slipper, which is a very well known full canopy dragster from that era, and it isn't. The Glass Slipper was built 2 years prior to this car. The Glass Slipper had a flathead. This has got a Hemi. There's the Hemi motor
picture. At that.
Yeah. And it's got
intake.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. It's really, really trick. So that car was built by Romeo Palomides, one of the founders of American Racing Wheels.
You know, that intake looks like if you look at a modern modern Dodge 6.4 Hemi,
yeah.
It looks like that.
Yeah,
like,
you know,
but
you're
that's
right.
That's actual pipes.
I've never thought of that, but you're absolutely
it
right.
It really looks
because
just
even
like
on
it.
Some of the plastic covers,
yeah.
You know, that's all you see
it
anymore.
It looks exactly like that.
Yeah, yeah, they do
really
do that
cool.
treatment a lot of times. So that's a cool car, and it was
really
on the
cool.
Cover of the 59 Hot Rod Magazine annual. There's another car that it's maybe not pictured here because we just throw on a few cars for the, you know, this website, just so it's there. But
yeah.
But anyway, is the first midget that Frank Curtis designed and built in South Central LA. And the one in the lower right, that's
Parks
a...
Parks Novelty Machine
yeah, that's
Company?
Yeah, that's a tribute to the first NASCAR champion, 1948. And
I read that your family was the first ever sponsor in NASCAR,
that's
period.
Right. That's right. Yeah, I've got, and if I didn't have photos to prove that point, along with some other documentation, I'm sure people would have a tendency to say, you know,
you sponsor a driver or the whole series?
Multiple drivers, okay, not the series, because they weren't really doing contingency at that time.
Mm-hmm.
You got to remember, NASCAR was founded by Bill France. Nobody ever thought it would turn into what it has, okay? Nobody. I've said to drivers today, you know, no drivers were never supposed to make the money you make. And
I bet they love hearing that.
Well, you know, it is true, though.
But they must be happy that they do.
Yeah, the typical response is, well, I'm glad that I came along at the right time.
Yeah.
Well, and it seems like that time maybe has peaked because mm-hmm. Jimmy Johnson did an article and said that a lot of the drivers now are getting paid 50% of what they were, and some drivers can't afford insurance. I'll leave it to him, and if you want to look up that article, I forget where it was, but he was interviewed and said that. But anyway, so, you know, everything peaks and valleys. You know, it goes in cycles. But this car, this is a 39 Ford Standard Coupe. And after the war, there weren't a lot of new cars. And so the first year of NASCAR were these old cars. And the 39 Ford Standard Coupe was the stereotypical moonshine car.
Right, yeah.
It was the first year of hydraulic brakes for Ford. So you had the flathead from 32, right? And when 39 came along and he had hydraulic brakes, well, that was a magical combination.
Yeah.
Because prior to that, mechanical brakes, it's like, you know, you call ahead for appointment to stop and hope that you stop, you know. And so the original car does not survive. So years ago, I actually, my wife found this car in the black condition, not lettered, not mm-hmm. done with everything, on eBay. And she was going to buy it for me for my birthday, but she didn't want to pull the trigger, not knowing for sure if it wasn't 100% right. So she told me the surprise. I went on and checked out the car, and I go, wow, yeah, this is the real deal. It was in Tucson, Arizona, and just by 6 degrees of separation, the guy that owned it, his father-in-law was an IndyCar driver, Bill Cheeseberg. And it's unbelievable. And I found that out after we had negotiated a price and delivery and all that. And then I told him who I was. And he goes, well, you probably knew my father-in-law, Bill Cheeseberg. And I go, yeah, of course I did. And so
oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's just so weird. So yeah. That was, you know, that's.
You ever drive this
That
thing?
Was the first, yeah. That was the first, not at night, because the standard only came with one small taillight. The standard was the business coupe, was the nickname. It was the cheap model.
Yeah.
Okay. So it doesn't have a lock on that side of the door. You got to get in on the passenger side, which they wanted you to do anyway because they felt it was unsafe getting on the driver's side.
Right, right.
So
yeah, you got to get on the curb side.
It didn't
yeah.
have a heater, but with a flathead, you don't need a heater because they run hot anyway. It had one windshield wiper. I mean, they just did all this cost reduction, which was ridiculous.
And to call it the business coupe.
Yeah.
Ford had a long history of doing that, yeah, of making up fancy names for their
cheap. Now, a lot of people, when they see the car
from the front.
Starting
business.
LTD, huh? Limited? Yeah. I see.
Yeah. Yeah, they when people see this car, and actually Dan Gurney said this, he goes, oh, it's a 38 Deluxe. And I said, no, it's actually a 39 Standard, but I do know why you made the mistake, and so do you. Because Ford at that era, they would take the previous year's deluxe model and make it the cheap standard model the next year.
Uh-huh.
So, because they were changing tooling every year. Well, think about
that.
God, that's
every
crazy.
Year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they'd get an extra year out of the tooling by selling it another year
I
as
wonder
a standard
if that,
model.
Is that because the tooling wore out so fast that they had to, or because the design was moving so fast?
I think it was the design. I mean, you know, they were trying to give people a reason to buy the new model.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And from 39 to 40, of course, was a big jump because a 40 Ford is a very iconic car. It went more Art Deco design.
Right, right.
This car is very old in its look by comparison, which I
Because that was
I
after the, was
like.
The Y, was it the Y job or the concept car?
Yeah,
the
GM.
The GM
yeah.
that really, and it was like, everyone was like, oh, we're going Art Deco.
Yeah.
Pivot.
Yep, yep.
You know.
So anyway, this is a fun car. And yeah, in 1950, talking about this NASCAR sponsorship. So in 1950, my dad was 29 years of age, and he was the youngest of the brothers. And they sponsored Johnny Parsons at Indy for the whole season. Frank Curtis, there's a copy of the letter in the book, wrote my uncle a letter offering the sponsorship for $5,000. Primary only sponsor in the car for the whole season. Frank then threw in a second car at Indianapolis. We won the 500, my dad and uncles. It's a little bit deeper in the book there. They won deeper even.
Deeper even.
Yeah.
So you know what year we're looking for here.
Yeah, it'll be somewhere along in here, okay. Maybe. So a little bit deeper. Anyway,
first NASCAR uniforms.
Yeah, they made my dad and uncles made the first uniforms in NASCAR, 500 of them. So, and that was later in 1950. Oh. So
there's the letter.
Yeah,
there we go.
I have the original letter. It's actually a pretty amazing document.
We have set a price of $5,000 for the season, which might appear high. However, considering the potential results, you will find that it is not out of reason. Sincerely yours, Frank Curtis.
The potential results. And we ended up in victory
lane. What were the
lane.
Potential results?
Yeah, we won.
Winning, right?
Right.
So there
and
you go.
It,
5 G's
changed,
well spent.
It changed our life.
Turns out Frank Curtis knew a thing or two.
Yeah, well, you know, that was his first time to win. He had entered the car in 49, that same car, and it won the championship in 49. That's why it carries the number one on it.
Oh.
So it was like, you know, they sponsored the national champion.
Yeah.
And so that wasn't bad. And so then later in the year, a guy by the name of Harold Brazington built the first super speedway in NASCAR history called Darlington in Darlington, South Carolina. And it was the first 500-mile race for NASCAR, 1950. And it was also the first NASCAR race on pavement. And so there were like 70-plus entries. And it was a mile and a half. They called that a super speedway back in that time.
Is the current Darlington on the same exact track?
Same track. Yeah. Too tough to tame. Yeah. You know, it's an egg shape.
Yeah.
And there's all sorts of stories why that is, the minnow pond and all that. And it's all true. But anyway, so they sponsored a vast majority of the cars, and there's a whole section on that in the book, in that race. And a guy from Long Beach, California, by the name of Johnny Mance, ends up winning the race. And so my dad, they won the Indy 500, and they won the first NASCAR 500-mile race, the Southern 500, and my dad was 29.
It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, so now what do I do?
Yeah. You
know, maybe I'll retire at 30, 31.
But pretty impressive.
Yeah, well, and the reason why Johnny Mance won, he actually was like the slowest qualifier, but he was the only guy that put truck tires on his car.
Oh.
The tires back in that era were so bad, cotton cord, that they were running out of tires. The track.
I'm guessing they wouldn't do tire changes mid-race, right?
Well, they did, yeah. But the track had seashells in the asphalt.
Oh, yeah.
So it was like razor blades.
Yeah.
So it just wore the tires out. And they ran out of tires, and the teams actually were going to the spectators' cars in the parking lot pulling tire wheels off.
They do that in like Lemons Racing now.
No, they. This is legit.
Yeah,
and,
that's crazy.
So anyway, but Johnny, just because he stayed on the track longer.
Yeah.
You know, today.
Well, that's a strategy in endurance racing today, isn't it?
That's the strategy in all
racing. And that's North Carolina?
Today. Yeah, South Carolina.
In South Carolina. My parents have a place in South Carolina.
Oh, really?
I've been going there for 20 years. And it's so funny that you mentioned the seashells, because it is a very popular building material down there called tabby that's made of mud and seashells.
Yeah.
And it's a very attractive thing. Like, my parents, like, they're literally, their back deck is made of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fucking razor sharp, and it cuts your feet up.
Yeah.
It cuts your shoes
up. Security.
And I can't imagine if you raced on it for 10 minutes, your tires would be completely disintegrated.
Yeah.
Funny that the tabby was used at the racetrack.
Yeah.
It's such a South Carolina thing. Six people listening to this show will understand that reference. But if you've been to South Carolina, you know about tabby.
Well, you know, I'm by birthright, I'm a Southerner. I was born in Jacksonville, Florida, which is actually considered to be more Georgia-esque than Florida-esque, because it's North Florida. It's right on the Florida-Georgia line. And so, you know, I mean, I could make Southern jokes, and legitimately I can get away with it. But anyway.
I mean, knock yourself out. You got a microphone. Yeah.
No, but, you know, my dad, they were from Kansas City. He came to California, worked at Douglas Aircraft up in Santa Monica at Cloverfield, worked under Donald Douglas Jr. in the flight test department. And then we went to Florida for 10 years. It's all explained in the book why, for business opportunity. And I was born during that time. And then my dad wanted to get back to California for obvious reasons. And, you know, I mean, my dad loved California so much. He loved the whole palm trees. I mean, we got palm trees all over our building. The Klieg lights. I mean, he came to California pre-war, and that was a really special time in California history.
Yeah.
You know, this is when they were advertising, trying to get people to move to California.
Yeah,
come on out here. It's great. Really, you'll like it.
There's still, you know, like, you know, farms and where Beverly Hills was and
totally.
Stuff like that. Yeah.
There was a chicken farm. There was all sorts of farms when I was growing up.
Yeah.
I mean,
it was a real transitionary period in LA history.
There were lots
of
orange groves in the San Gabriel Valley.
Yeah.
Lots of orange groves.
Yeah.
So anyway.
And then you had right where we are here, you had Hughes Aircraft across the street from us.
Yeah.
And then you had Shelby up the street in Venice a little later.
Horsepower Alley. Well, he was up on in Oh God,
he was off Lincoln in Venice.
Yeah,
and right. And then we had Vic Edelbrock right here,
right,
and Iskenderian is around
Iskenderian,
the corner.
Yeah.
He's still there. The building's still there.
I know, with the lettering. Yeah.
It's
amazing?
Right around the corner.
Yeah, yeah. And you also Horsepower race. Alley was where Dick Gullstrand was the last guy to move out.
Yeah,
but Troutman and Barnes were there. There was a number of people in there,
and they used to race right here on Jefferson. Yeah. Right up and down the street. That's the street
right
here.
Yeah, Shelby's building was originally, Lance Reventlow's building.
Well, I don't know that name. Who's that?
Lance Reventlow was the son of, I think it was Barbara Hutton, the Woolworth.
Oh,
Woolworth.
Yeah.
Nickel and dime and all that. And he created the Scarabs.
Oh, the boats.
No, the cars, the road racing cars.
Oh, the
cars.
Scarab, the cars, right.
So anyway, when Reventlow killed his deal,
those
Shelby,
things, they looked kind of like European-esque, like those on the top, yeah.
Yeah,
that, sort of like a Ferrari 250 TR, nutty little things.
Emil Diet worked on a lot of the body work on that. He was my uncle's, one of his best friends. Emil was the second employee at Curtis Craft right after my uncle. And he was the absolute, most people that worked with him felt, the dean of metalworkers. He was old school German guy and pretty amazing.
Got some questions for you.
But anyway, Shelby, Reventlow continued to own that building, and he would come collect the rent from Shelby. And when he'd come collect the rent, he'd be in a hot rod sports car or one of those Scarabs maybe, and he'd yell up, "Billy Saul," and because Nick Shelby's nickname to a few on the inside was Billy Saul,
was a
name of taken from a guy by the name of Billy Saul Estes, Estes, who was a got convicted for doing con stuff in Texas. And so that was Shelby's nickname to a lot of the people.
That's funny.
Yeah. Yeah. Rem, you know, Phil Remington and all of them. But
we, and there's a guy who we used to work with Shelby, this guy who I just met, Charlie Agapu, who's now got this Rolls Royce repair business up there.
Charlie who? Is what he went by.
Yeah,
Charlie, I went by there after
I was like,
Ford.
When I met him, I was like, because I met him as a Rolls Royce mechanic.
Yeah.
And I was like, God, this name is familiar.
Yeah.
And I was like,
well, the Agapu brothers.
Shelby, He's the guy.
Great guy.
Yeah. He's cool.
And his brother's in there and all. I stopped by after the Ford versus Ferrari, and I tried to nudge him into reissuing the Charlie Who t-shirts. I said, buddy, you got to ride this
wave. You should ride the wave. Everyone else is.
Right. And it was funny because I had the best visit with him because I hadn't seen him in a long time. And we used to race against him in Formula 5000. And great, great guy. He used to be up on Santa Monica Boulevard in Beverly Hills. And he moved to that new location, probably where you went.
Yeah.
And just a great guy. Yeah. Oh, man, I mean, he knows.
If you got an old Rolls or Bentley, he's your guy.
And he knows everybody.
Yeah.
He could write a book.
Yeah, and should.
Yeah, probably won't.
We got a few questions from our fans. If you don't mind. Meh says, does Ed think you can learn to conquer the fear? I've taken a handful of racing classes, and I feel like I'll never get above a certain level as I have the fear. How do you address it or work around it? I can relate to this. I like going fast. I like track driving. I even like racing, but I will never be a champion because I drive with the fear.
Well, I will respond to that question by what I've learned from a number of the great drivers that I've known. And had a chance to interview and have lunch and talk just casually and everything. Number one, the misconception for a lot of race car drivers is that they have a death wish. You know, people think these guys or gals now today have a death wish. And the fact of the matter is, based on my years of talking to these people, I think it's the exact opposite. I think they have a life wish. Mm. And how I can explain that is by driving at the level that these people drive, a Dan Gurney, an A.J. Foyt, Johnny Rutherford. I could go down a whole list. The Unser brothers, et cetera. And surviving and winning, it makes you feel alive like no other.
Yeah.
And they also have a higher sense of denial than you and I do.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
We all live in the world of denial.
Yeah.
Okay. If you didn't, you wouldn't get in your car. Because you see, when you get in your car, in effect, you're saying, it would never happen to me. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to get in a wreck. I mean, you cannot live without some denial. Okay. Their denial is that much higher. When I talked to Dan Gurney one time, this was after Dale Earnhardt passed away. And I said, you know, Dan, it's interesting how this is playing out. And I said, you know, back in the day, 10 of the top drivers would die in a year.
Yeah.
And I mean, you could be the best. And if, as Foyt says,
well, in the late 60s in Formula One, it was like a 20% chance any given weekend you weren't coming back.
If it's your time, it's your time. That's AJ's feeling. Because he's been around a lot of them. And Dan said to me, I think it was 1966, he said, I lost 10 of my closest friends.
Yeah.
Now, how do you get back into a car and do that? It takes a special mindset. You either have it or you don't.
Yeah.
And so, Do I think, to answer his question, that, you know, you can muster it up? If you get in that zone where you're really uncomfortable and it's not your place, you're never going to be at the level they are.
Yeah,
You're never just going to be at that level. I mean, you know, Dan, at 66, he lost 10 friends. He lost his good friend Bruce McLaren, I think it was 70. And Dan drove his last IndyCar race in 1970. I've got a picture, that one picture I gave you of Gurney. I shot it. It's down below probably here. Right there. Yeah. That's California 500, 1970. That's Dan Gurney's last IndyCar race. And I was 15 when I took that picture.
Really?
And
amazing.
Yeah, I started at 14, believe it or not. And
for one-year experience, that's a very good shot.
Yeah.
It's framed really nice.
Actually, I got my first camera at 12, okay? So 14, I started selling pictures to the magazines. Okay, it was different back then, okay?
Yeah.
Let me just tell you, all right? It was different. And I'd have my dad or my uncle drive me to the magazine. They'd drive me to the track. I mean, before I got my license, I was dependent always on somebody. But so I walked up to Dan. I shot a lot of the drivers that day, and I was covering it for, I forget, some publication. And I said, you know, Mr. Gurney, would you squat down next to the car? And like I tell people, this type of picture you cannot shoot anymore because – number one, there wasn't a PR person there that was an intermediary.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, you can't talk to Mr. Gurney. I mean, drivers were very accessible. They didn't have the motor coaches to hide in. They walked to and from the car or the garage. They didn't scoot on a scooter or, you know, to not engage. And so he had just gotten out of the car and took his helmet off. You can see his hair's messed up.
Yeah.
His hand's dirty.
Yeah.
And that's what they would call reportage or, reporting, journalistic photography. That's in the moment.
Yeah.
And
it's a great picture.
Yeah, thank you. But today, you know, you make an appointment, the PR person will be there, they'll make sure the top of the
get the hair suit and makeup going on.
Like,
make sure you get the right sponsor
it's
hat.
It's so contrived.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's taken a lot of the fun out of it.
But. Makes sense. Dante Casale, we didn't talk about this very much on this show, but your family's been in the automotive parts and service business for a very long time. And he wants to know, do penetrating lubricants work, or are they hope in a bottle that make a mess?
Okay, so he's sort of addressing two things there. Penetrating lubricant typically, in my world, comes in an aerosol can, okay, like our JB80.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they do work. You talk to the teams that use our products, there's a can of it sitting in the toolbox there. Now, if he also wants to know about the oil additives that come in the bottle, yes, they do work. I show dyno test reports. I've had people do them before and after. You pick up like the engine oil supplement there that's on the screen. You pick up torque and horsepower. After you do everything else by reducing friction, you're going to pick up torque and horsepower. In today's world, easiest way for me to explain this, We have one product that's an intake valve cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they have what they call borescopes. You know, you take the plug out and you go down and you look. If I say that that product cleans intake valves, there's no mystery. Like, do you think it really cleaned it or what do you think? You take the plug out, you go down, and you look at the borescope, and it either cleaned it or it didn't.
Yeah.
Okay? So today you can measure everything. You know, now, back in the day, were there some products that claimed, you know, I mean, look at, there's all sorts of automotive accessories there from the tailpipe to in the engine that make all sorts of horsepower gain claims that sometimes are hard to replicate.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, throw this air cleaner on and you're going to get X number.
Yeah.
How do you, when you do that, how do you know? Okay, how
you
do
don't.
You don't. Okay.
You don't. And there's most also, people don't have
a tornado.
And it's just,
have
it's just,
to a dyno
yeah, it's just
out.
Also the same in a lot of other things. I mean, you know,
and also there's
you,
ways to fake your you, body. If
use
it, if it
this
makes
shampoo.
The car louder.
Yeah, use this shampoo. It's going to make your hair fuller and you know, it's going to cause hair to grow or not, unless it's Regain or whatever.
Yeah, Rogaine.
Yeah, yeah, Rogaine. Yeah, whatever. Yeah.
Okay, good answer. So, Jonathan K. says, Ed, Drive to Survive on Netflix has increased the popularity of the F1 in the U.S. by over 300%. I'm guessing, I'm not sure how that metric is achieved, but I'm sure it has improved it a lot. I think it's probably a combination of that and how the series' current stewards are choosing to televise film broadcast those races, but we'll go with that. Do you keep in contact with the decision makers in IndyCar, and are you aware of any efforts to create a similar docuseries in order to increase the IndyCar fan base?
Yeah, I do keep in touch with people, and I don't know of anything exactly right now. This is a very common conversation right now, because you take last season in IndyCar would have made a great series. I mean, with the constant new winner and coming down to the championship with Alex Palou and Pato Ward, who Pato I sponsored for a number of years in IMSA and also in the feeder series, who's a great guy. And Alex is a great guy. I mean, there's some great young talent there. And I, truthfully, I know this is going to probably upset some, but I think the competition level in IndyCar is about as good as it gets. And while I think Formula One is great, come on. What is the chance of the car from the fourth row winning the race?
Yeah, it's small.
Okay. I mean, and you know, the amazing thing about Formula One that I've always thought was interesting is you can have both cars on a team and they'll qualify with incredible parity.
Mm-hmm.
They'll be very close. Now, you go to like Hendrick's stock car team, and when you had Jimmy and Jeff Gordon and whoever else, Dale Jr. and whatever, there was no parity. I mean, they'd be all over through the field potentially. And the same thing can happen like in an IndyCar. And so that tells you something. And I'll leave it to you to figure out, you know what I mean? But the parity of qualifying, like, you know, the Mercedes will qualify very close. The Ferraris will qualify. Now, sometimes now, and the new, look at F1, we all know if you follow it, it's new ownership.
Yeah.
They're trying to make changes. A lot of changes a lot of people feel are overdue to make.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just so happens a good friend of mine is their director of race development for new races for F1. And so we'll see where they go. I mean, you know,
I think in F1 the car matters a little more, and in other series the driver matters a little more.
Yeah.
You know, and it's only a few percentage points either way. It's not like it's 80-20 and 20-80. It could be 50-58, you know, 42
right.
or 42-48 or whatever.
Look at I asked Jean Todt when he was in charge of Ferrari when Schumacher was running. And Michael Schumacher, fantastic racer. I have incredible respect for him. I love that new documentary that came out. I'm glad to see his wife, you know, talking about him and all. It seems like they're at a different point now than maybe they were a few years ago and whatever. It's a tragedy what
it's
happened with
sad.
Michael. But I asked John Todd what percent was car and what percent was driver. And he said 95% car, and I'm quoting him. And I mean, that was it. He said 95% car. So back
That's
to
high.
His
That's
point.
That's a high number.
back to his point. Well, you can't carry a car today like you used to. You know, back in the day, a guy like Foyt or Parnelli Jones, you know, another unbelievably talented driver, you could carry the car more.
Mm-hmm.
Those days are long gone. And to his point, I would love to see IndyCar have a series like that, and I think it would do IndyCar a lot of good. And so he's not alone.
I haven't followed much IndyCar.
Yeah, he's not alone.
I go to the Long Beach Grand Prix. I enjoy watching that race. You know, I've watched some of the Indy 500. I've met some of the drivers. I could see, you know, the talent that's required there. But I haven't found a way to get myself invested in that series. And so I don't know about you, but like I like watching documentaries about sports more than I like watching the sport. That's just me. I'm not really a live sports guy.
I like documentaries, period.
Yeah.
I find myself watching more documentaries about everything.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
And I like that there's more of them out there now.
I actually watched this series on Netflix 7 days out. And actually, one of the ones I thought was really very interesting was Karl Lagerfeld and this fashion show. Not necessarily a guy thing, but these like Paris Fashion Week or whatever it is, the money that is spent and it's
nuts.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And to see, because Karl Lagerfeld was a photographer also, an incredibly talented guy. I mean, the guy knew how to create a brand, et cetera. And I just was so fascinated seeing that world that I know nothing about.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But
my dad's in the fashion business.
Oh, is he?
So I've been around that
tough
kind
business.
Of stuff. Very tough business.
Tough business,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, yeah. So anything
anyway,
else for
well,
Ed?
You know,
is
this question, that isn't necessarily for me, but
if you have a point of view, we'd love
well,
to we'll finish
you know,
on
this,
it.
Well, you know, this thing about
let me read
negative.
It. Let me read it first. And I think this is the last one that is for Ed, right?
Yep.
Okay, cool. So we'll end our show on this one. Gavin Sorensen, many companies seem to be in their prime, referring to car companies, when naturally aspirated engines were far more common. Of course, this is subjective. In a theoretical situation where a company develops a biofuel with limited to no negative environmental impacts, do you think companies would gradually go back to naturally aspirated engines or stick to forced induction for efficiency and power reasons? Do you have an opinion on that, Ed?
Well, I think... Wow, there's just so much in
there's
that
a lot
question.
In there. So I'll start unpacking this.
Okay,
the reason
go ahead.
That enthusiasts have the opinion that companies are in their prime when they have we're using naturally aspirated engines is because there's more opportunity to develop character of high revving, how do the valve train sound?
Right.
The displacement of the engine versus the cylinder configuration versus the valve train configuration. There's opportunities to develop character. There's also instant throttle response compared to a turbo that has to spool up or whatever. And there's racing, right? The naturally aspirated engines lasted longer in racing than the turbocharged engines did. Now, when everyone's got a turbocharged engine, the engines kind of start to feel the same a little bit, and they've sort of figured out the optimum configurations for efficiency. The 4-liter hot V8 for one, or the turbo 2-liter 4 for the other, or the twin turbo 6 is sort of common across different manufacturers and platforms, and things start to feel a little more the same. But I don't think the reason that they do that is necessarily because of the fuel that they're using. I think it's because of the fuel economy testing.
Totally.
And that engine being optimized for that test.
It's totally for that. They're trying to meet the numbers, and the turbo is one of the bags or tricks in your bag.
Yeah.
Okay. There's
in very light throttle applications such as that test. The turbocharged engine will fare much better.
There's a lot of truth to that.
On a racetrack,
a
500 horsepower engine that's a twin turbo 6 and a 500 horsepower engine that's a V8 will use the same amount of fuel.
You know, It really, I mean, I know he didn't bring in the electric thing in this, right. But as we rush to electric cars, and there's some amazing things going on, there's not a lot of questions being asked, and the ones that are being asked are not necessarily being answered.
Mm-hmm.
It's just 100% this is the way to go. We're not looking at the total carbon footprint.
Right.
And I know pro-electric people will argue this all day long, but I'll be happy to produce tons of opinions from experts that are not mine, that I've read, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, where we get these rare earth metals from... Yeah.
We're just outsourcing our dirtiness to somewhere we don't have to look at.
And also we're taking a dependence upon one part of the world and putting it on another part of the
right.
world.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And anyway, so it's a big subject, but I've driven, look at, I've owned cars with the twin turbo V6 configuration for fuel economy, and then I've owned V8s with the cylinder deactivation. And I tell you, at the end of the day, the fuel economy is about the same.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
At the end of the we're going back to where you
real
were.
World, real it ends world. Up being pretty
I mean,
much
I,
the same.
When I was doing Road and Track Radio, I got one of the first Priuses out there. Maybe it was when I was on Car and Driver at the time. And I remember I was amazed by the vehicle. I really was truly impressed by the technology and all that. Went up, got my dad. He was still alive. Said, you got to come down, sit in this car. This is amazing. Look at the leaves growing on the screen and all that. And so I had that thing for a while, and I drove it like my grandmother had the car.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I used every opportunity to coast. I did everything in my power that I felt to get the best fuel economy. I was never able to get these numbers that people tell me they get with their Priuses.
Yeah.
And, you know, I take some of this is just like the size of the fish you caught. I mean, people loved it. Oh, my God, I got, you know, 65 miles per gallon. And it's like, how did you get that?
Yeah.
You know, oh, no. I mean, you know, a lot of times
you want to project that it's coming and that yeah. it's happening.
Or people look at the instant fuel miles per gallon and when they lift it off throttle downhill.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, so anyway, whatever.
I'm with you on the total environmental impact though, and not just okay, if we have a city full of EVs, we will have cleaner air in the city.
Yeah.
But we're outsourcing that filth to somewhere else. That we don't necessarily have to look
at. And you know, we live on a planet.
Yeah.
Okay. And the planet has trade winds.
Just like Spaceballs.
And you know, when a volcano erupts in the Philippines or wherever,
yeah,
we get the ash a few days later.
Yeah.
If China has got a massive pollution problem, and I've traveled to China many times, okay, that doesn't stay here. California, what we do here, the air does not stay within our
imaginary when there's big fires here, it goes
boundary.
Over to Colorado and whatever, you know.
Whatever, Chicago.
Yeah,
man,
yeah.
They were getting
York,
in the
yeah.
East Coast.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
yeah,
New York. I mean, I had relatives on my wife's side calling from New York saying, it's unbelievable, orange sunset here tonight. So, you know, it's just such a bigger subject than it's generally addressed.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, every time somebody passes me on the freeway going 90 miles an hour in Prius, when I call it what I call full green mode, I go, so what's the point here?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
You got in the carpool lane.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to give talks on alternative fuel vehicles to educate people on all, because hydrogen, I think, is viable. And if you talked to the engineers of a lot of the car companies, they think it is really still. Most of the engineers I've talked to don't see electric as being the final answer. They think it's a stepping stone to where we need to go.
Could be.
Yeah. And so anyway, you know, most of the people, when I'd ask them, raise your hand if you have an alternative fuel vehicle, and how many bought it to go in the carpool lane? Surprising.
Yeah. Well, they're not doing that. They're not doing stickers anymore.
That's surprising. Back in the time, and they'd come up to me, and most people would be honest and say, you know what? If I couldn't get in the carpool lane, I would not be driving this car.
Sure. I understand.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so all I'm doing is repeating what I've been told.
With a carpool lane sticker on it. It was pretty sweet.
Oh, I love the Volt.
The Volt's awesome. The Volt was a great car.
I wish they did not discontinue that. I talked to some of my friends at GM. I thought the Volt was
an amazing car.
I thought it was the perfect concept. And it's particularly as a transition vehicle.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because it's not a cold turkey if I'm halfway to Vegas.
No.
Where do I charge?
95% of the time I drove on electric. Yep. And if I needed to go further, I just kept driving further.
The Volt was, I thought GM did a stellar job on that car.
Yeah, that thing was awesome.
And, yeah.
$475 a month, no money down for the lease, and I got something like 190 miles per gallon net with it. It was awesome.
You know, I'm very concerned about the car companies because of the investments that they are expected to do in the billions of dollars. And manufacturing cars, I interviewed Bob Lutz a number of times, and one time up in Napa, I got to have breakfast, lunch, and dinner with Bob. And,
Is he eating bacon for every single meal?
No. But he really explained, you know, he really put it in more real-world terms about how capital-intensive the car manufacturing business is.
Oh, yeah.
And just how hard it is for them to really make sure they're profitable.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks it's just a walk in the park, but it's no, right it's, now, see, the car industry's in a different place. And car dealers are making great money because you can't get any, and so.
I had a friend who was a chief design engineer at Ford SVT, Jamal Hamidi. I don't know if you ever met him. He's at Jaguar Land Rover SVR now.
Mm-hmm.
And when they went from the 2009 to 2010 Shelby GT500, the rear badge went from a little 5-inch thing that said Shelby on a corner to the spread out letters across the back.
Mm-hmm.
That change was almost $2 million, he told me, to change the badge on the car.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. It's like, how many Shelbys do you have to sell to justify changing this badge? You know, and so that one note put in perspective, you know, the scale of Matt, because they had to get a new robot.
It's
a different robot to do that.
You know what?
You know,
things that look very simple.
Yeah.
Typically, can it be very complicated?
Yeah. Well, Ed, this was a pleasure. Thank you very much for coming down.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Where can people buy the book? Everywhere
on Amazon.
The Legacy.
Yeah.
Legacy of Justice. American Family Story. This is a beautiful coffee table book. Comes in a lovely presentation box.
Well, that's the limited edition.
The limited edition.
This is the regular book. Yeah, that's the regular book that's non-numbered is I think $90
Number 197.
Yeah, out of 200.
Oh, really?
Right.
Running low.
But it's the regular book, non-numbered, trade edition, they call it, is $90.
Awesome.
And I got to say, the Wood Brothers, they got copies. Jim Farley put me in touch with the Wood Brothers. It's gotten, well, Dan Gurney and Parnelli Jones wrote the foreword for the book, and I was hugely honored by that.
Well, it's a really cool book. It's going to live here at Westside, and you can read my limited edition copy if you become a member, Westside Collector Car Storage. Thank you to all of our Patreon members for sharing questions. If you had generic car questions, we will save them for the next crew show. And of course, definitely follow Ed's Instagram. It's just Ed Justice Jr.
Yeah, Ed Justice JR.
Ed Justice JR on Instagram. He is a fantastic follow if you are interested in car history, motorsport history, California racing history, just general Americana awesomeness, and some contemporary photography.
Yeah, a lot of contemporary. Yeah. I still shoot.
And of course, Justice Brothers for all your penetrating lubricants.
Right, right, exactly.
Thanks for coming in, Ed.
Hey,
it was a great
time. It's been really a pleasure.
Really enjoyed having you.
We've been all over the board talking about a little bit of everything, and I've really enjoyed myself.
That's what we do here.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We will be back with the crew show next time, and see y'all later. Bye.